really, really excited to begin this hour with one of my very favorite writers, the immensely talented Colin Fleming. Colin, welcome.
Mr. Pratt, buddy, commandeering the big chair.
Yeah, I moved to the air chair because they just can't find anybody else. But
time has come, my friend. Legality, time.
Well, it's funny because I was saying to Carrie, I usually am in here on Fridays during football season when Rich is out of town covering the University of Maine game, doing the University of Maine games, and I keep looking down for all the things that are supposed to happen on Friday, and it's not Friday, it's Tuesday, which means we get to talk to you. We get to talk to you about your wonderful new book, which is just great, called Meatheads Say the Realest Things. And I want to talk to you about something about that first, before specifically on sort of a philosophical angle. You are extraordinary, what an old teacher of mine used to call multum in parvo, saying much in little, revealing rather than explaining. So many of your characters clearly arise from your imagination. These aren't the kids you grew up with. This is your incredible imagination. When you were putting this book together, how did each of these people appear to you? That each of the bros, each of the Chads, each of the people that were with them, how did they come to you?
You mean in terms of like their source origin? That I,
yeah.
I guess normally, like what someone might say is, I knew this guy in high school, and he made me think about this, something he said stuck in my mind. But really what I did was one morning, and it was a 7-day process, one morning I said, okay, this is a good idea for a book. Who do you want to be in this book? And I just started going. And once I got about 3 or 4 days in, I thought, well, in terms of posterity, in terms of history, you can do this in a week. And it's going to be something that you might not want to tell people about right now. But looking back on it, people, when the book gets to a certain reputation, a certain renown, a certain audience, they can say, and did you know we did that in a week? But as I was actually doing it, it would come to me. I look at writing for me because it's what my background is in a kind of music. It's almost like sitting down and the keyboard is a piano keyboard, and I allow the characters to come to me. And once they come to me, they're going to do the work. And I think that's really the origin story for anything that I come up with or any character I come up with. Certainly at this point in my development is I let them do that legwork, and I am going to be open and to receive what they have to say, but I trust them. I feel like they're more real than people out in the world, and it's not my job to do anything other than to stop myself from inhibiting their realness, and that's going to do a lot of the writing for me.
That's what I was going to get to next. All of the characters have a humanity in them that I find missing in so much contemporary fiction. As you know, I've read more than 10,000 short stories in my life as an editor, a teacher, a writer. And what seems to be so lacking today are characters who seem human. They seem to be more like props in a story. Whether you're writing from the point of view of a young girl or a mother or a father or a kid out for a walk, these people seem like people I could run into. I don't know them, but when I run into them and I meet them, I say, oh, now I see who they are. You write so often from a female point of view or from a child's point of view or the like. What is it that intrigues you the most about doing that kind of writing?
I've done a lot of that in the last 2+ years, and one of the reasons I started doing that was because I had so many hundreds of works before that, and I just started to think, one, there's this paint box, and I might not have been using all of the paint box in one sense, but I was actually writing about this on the blog today. If you're writing about a female character, and that's like the driving character of a story or a novel or whatever it might be, there also has to be a masculine quality, and vice versa if you're writing about a guy. By which I mean by that is, even if you're using one essential color, you have to have the other colors in there. People have to know that you have them, even if you're not in that very moment using them. And what you get now with contemporary fiction is you get one watered-down color. You get that exclusivity of the color. You don't get that municipality, that multiplicity of humanness. You get just, okay, this is their go-to color. This is what they're using. Orson Welles talked about how a work has to be both masculine and feminine. And you can have a work like I wrote one today, and everyone in the story is a female. But you are also aware of that other side. You're aware of the reverse. You have the obverse and you have the reverse, even if only one is explicit. And I think that's the key to realness in the story, to humanness in the story, to that sensation that someone that you're reading about who is invented might as well live in Chicago, and they can be out there into the world, and if you head out one night, you might run into them at the Starbucks or whatnot.
Yeah, and you know what I really like about Meatheads, and I think this is an extraordinary part of it. I've been fascinated my whole life with characters who have just enough information to make a bad decision, or who think they know more than they do. And it's not that they're malevolent or that they're somehow a bad person, but they do things thinking they know what they're doing when they really don't have all the info. And man, you got some bros that are good guys at heart who make some foolish decisions because they really don't know any better.
Deleterious decisions that can wreck lives with a seemingly blithe cruelty throughout the book, but not sort of that pre-planned mendacity of I'm going to get somebody, I'm going to do them in. But the result is the same. And I think when the result is the same, the culpability ultimately becomes the same, but we don't have that condemnation of someone else's morality. And Chad, the main character of this novel, he causes a lot of damage in people's lives. And sometimes he causes that damage because of how he feels about himself. I think that's a very dominant form of societal damage right now that we do to each other. A lot of it stems from our discontent with who we are, because we know on some level what we aren't and what we ought to be. Maybe it's not like the conscious level of thinking that through, but that colors our actions, certainly. And yes, you have these guys in this novel who, right from the first chapter, with his sort of like right-hand meathead bro, who does something nefarious to him, but he wouldn't have termed it that way. And I think that's something that the book tries to crystallize, this idea of just because you think, it's like when people say they're sorry, and people will apologize to me about things, and I'll say to them, not to be like ungrateful, but it's like, it's not really the point. The point is the understanding of the behavior rather than the regret that you caused somebody pain. So that was something I definitely wanted to delineate in a very funny way, and also in a very gutting way at other times in this book.
Well, and I think it also, it's so impressive because I've read so many of your shorter pieces that you're working, I know you're working on a new project, that and been incredibly impressed by the fact that they're not flash fiction. They're stories. No. And we've gotten a place in literature now where we have flash fiction, we have shorter short stories, but we don't have stories. We have these little slice of life slacker tales or whatever. When you're envisioning how to put a story in a smaller space. I mean, I know some of it just happens, but when you do that, what do you think is it? And I couldn't put my finger on it. You reveal characters so quickly. What is it you're striving to do there?
You have to give someone the entirety of a character's life and being and heart and soul and mind, oftentimes within a word or a clause. And that sounds like a pipe dream, like you're not able to do that. It's not a matter of mere word selection. It's how words are going to relate to each other. And words have to have a multi-temporality to them in order to pull that off. And I was thinking about that today. You have to have words that exist within a given time period in the narrative that are also like pinging back into somebody's past and are pinging forward towards someone's expectations or hopes of what they want something to be. So you have that tieredness to every single word in a story. And sometimes it's overt, sometimes it's implied, but when you do that, you're creating a dimensionality that's not just going to be subject-verb. You're going to have that prismatic quality. So you can read the story that's 700 words long, but it's novelistic. And I abhor this notion of short shorts and microfiction, because normally it's a cop-out by a writer who's working with very little to put the onus on you with their faux depth, their vignette deepness, where it's all symbol or it's all metaphor. But that's what you try to paste together when you don't have, like in football terms, you don't have the roster.
Right.
People don't have the roster. And the idea that you could have a novelistic story with an arc and a beginning and a middle and an end was something that I had never seen before. Chekhov didn't even really do quite what I've been doing lately. They were longer often with him. So the way I was looking at it was, you're going to have to explain some of this. You're going to have to write an introduction for this book, because people in publishing can be so lazy. They'll do a word count and they'll just go short. And that's not something that I would ever write. And the stories, some of them that I'm writing now, in my development, I didn't have in me to write 3 years ago. It's all sort of that accumulation and that process and that growth.
Yeah, and what I think I find so fascinating is the way that we're watching fiction morph in all these different directions. And the truth of the matter still is, it isn't just subject, verb, object. It's real characters. It's real people, and it's the way the words are put together. And one of the things I wanted to ask you about is, and I think you do this very well, I think Jack Driscoll is one of the great masters of this, one of my very favorite short story writers. And that's what I call writing in the remembered voice. You have the point of view of the story from an adult looking back. When they look back, they talk like an adult. When the kid speaks back as a child, he speaks like a child. I think you are so masterful at managing that diction in that way, so that the point of view is always from above. We're always looking from above until we can see inside. And I wanted to say that on the air. I mean, I don't know if it requires a comment, but I think you do that so incredibly well.
The key is to make it remain active, to keep it moving forward. So you're using like a glancing blow of a voice. You're using, like, to think about it in musical terms again, you're arpeggiating. You're mm-hmm. you're just using like one portion of the chord, one strand of the chord, but it's enough of the chord, like, to incorporate that kind of plain song where you're giving that hint. But again, it's a glancing blow in that you're still moving forward. It's not just, okay, time to use the voice of the past right now. You have to have that melange that is part this, part that, which a reader is going to experience as a seamless whole. And that's, again, the whole idea of having 500 words count for 50,000 words. You're doing so many different techniques like this. And the actual techniques will be dictated by the needs of the story that the characters have to have told.
Yeah, I get that. And that's something I really admire in your work. Do you want to talk about Longer on the Inside for a second? We got a little bit of time left.
Sure. Yeah, fire away.
Well, you've created this book. I know the beginning and the end because I'm lucky enough to be one of the guys you share it with, stories. And you're developing an entire book of shorter pieces, which are not flash fiction, as we've talked about, and I totally agree. I think this should be the thing a publisher should want, so we don't hear any more about the lack of attention span of the American reader, which really isn't a lack of attention span. It's a lack of bad writing. It's a problem of bad writing.
Definitely is that.
How many stories do you think will end up being in here?
Oh, I don't know. There's probably 100 plus to pick from. So to do it is 40 or whatever it is. I mean, this week alone, I've written three. I've emailed them to you last week.
Oh, yeah.
I wrote the first one and I wrote the last one. It was six right there. And I already had more than enough. But it wasn't like, oh, okay, let's just wait until we get a number. I knew actively, like, if you actually look at the letters I've sent,
we'll
refer to, here's one for Longer on the Inside, very short fictions of infinitely human lives, not like, oh, I knocked out another one. So I was always conscious of the book, and it is a very, I'd say, like you had mentioned, a female-dominated book. But that idea, too, of inventing a new mode of narrative, and you had referenced Meatheads. You said it's unlike anything in contemporary fiction. It is a novel unlike any kind of novel. I defy someone to find, not in a cruel way, but I defy anyone to find a novel like that. And I defy anyone to find anything like these. They're shorter works in terms of only word count, because like the one I wrote today, I'm thinking like, yeah, I could think about this for the rest of my life. You could get the hands raised in the classroom, in other words. And part of the problem with publishing is that you have people who are marketing works that can be imitated easily. And I don't know how you imitate something like this. But in terms of the short attention span, right, I completely agree with you that that's not something that is so much out there. People will sit down and they'll binge watch a bad 15-hour Netflix program if it's what everybody else is doing. But you could sell it that way, that you have this avant-garde, progressive, new mode of post-postmodernism or whatnot, But you also have something that you can digest technically while you're sitting at the dentist office before you're called in for your 6-month cleaning.
Yeah, Colin, I'm excited for that book. I love Meatheads. I have all of your short story collections. There isn't a story I've read that I didn't say to myself, man, I'd have been happy to write that one. And, you know, writers tend to not always be that effusive about other writers. And I really want to thank you for joining us today and for talking about these kinds of things. I know you and Rich usually cover a lot of different things, art and music and all the things in which you are so versed and so expert. But I really want to thank you, and I want you to keep up the good battle. I'm battling for you, my man. And Rich will talk to you again next week.
Okay, sounds good, sir. I appreciate it.
All righty. Well, writer Colin Fleming.